This is Pete Fornatale back with you on Mixed Bag, and I'm pleased to present to you today our third annual Roger McGuinn update at WNEW-FM.
Going to the Gate of Home in my memory. Headlight flickering on a tablecloth. Big dark beer in front of me. How I wish that I was there, standing at the bar, listening to Mr. Gibson play on his fine guitar. He had a big old 12 string and it went something like this. Gate of Home, Gate of Home, glad I was Chicago born. Gate of Home meant everything to me. I was barely 17, little salty and a little green. Gate of Home meant everything to me. Sometimes there'd be a little jig like this. There was Judy and Peter and Josh and Odetta. The Clancys and Mary and Paul made it better. Grossman and Tommy and Dickie and Lou. When no one was looking, McGuinn was there too. But then they came and tore it down. Songbirds scattered and they all left town. Gate of Home meant everything to me. Gate of Home, glad I was Chicago bound. Gate of Home meant everything to me.
There are just a handful of songs, Roger McGuinn, that capture the ambiance of those days. That is certainly one of them.
Thank you.
Tell us non-Chicagoans about the Gate of Horn experience.
Well, it was it defies description, really. It was part of that whole 50s, late 50s folk thing, and the atmosphere at the time was really artsy, and there's like a renaissance of different kinds of art forms coming around at that point. And folk music was quite a big popular thing before the really mass appeal. It was starting to get a mass appeal. Mm-hmm. I guess it had started back in the late 40s with the Weavers and right. like that. But it was kind of like on the level that jazz was, you know, at the time, and I guess is now, mm-hmm. where it was getting a small but growing percentage of the listeners. And a lot of the people there were executives and, you know, people who basically were white-collar workers who'd come and play the five-string banjo on Sundays or something like that, and, you know. But then there were the professionals like Odetta and Bob Gibson and...
Oh, you packed a whole bunch of them in there, too,
yeah.
didn't you?
Judy and Peter and Josh and Odetta. That was Josh White and the Clancys and Mary and Paul made it better. I don't think Peter, Paul, and Mary as such ever played there, but it just sounded like, you know, a good thing to throw into that.
And Tommy and Dickie, we can assume?
Were the Smothers Brothers, but I don't think they played there, but Tom Paxton did, uh-huh. and Peter Yarrow did before he was with Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Now, you were living there at the time, Roger.
Right, I was living on the near north side, which was like the Greenwich Village of Chicago.
Uh-huh. And drawn to this like a moth to a flame, would
oh,
you
yeah.
say?
Well, see, I was going to a prep school on the near north side, and my music teacher was kind of into the folk scene. She'd come from Philadelphia, and they evidently had a folk scene there. And she brought Bob Gibson over to my high school in my second year. And I went from being a rockabilly fan to a folk fan overnight. Mm-hmm. And I enrolled in the Old Town School of Folk Music, and I started going down to the Gate of Horn and going to the Hootenannies on Sundays. Right. And then as I got a little older, I got, actually I got a fake ID. I shouldn't brag about it. But the drinking age was 21 in Chicago, and I needed a little help. So I started hanging out there at nights. And what I do is I was working at a coffee house down the street, and I'd play until like 2 in the morning, and then I'd pack up my banjo and guitar and walk over to the Gate of Horn and unpack one or the other of them and jam, because there's always something going on over there around the bar. And they were open till like 4 and 5 on Saturdays. So it was quite a late night scene.
Yes, you were obviously in training for your rock and roll days to come later.
Right. That's where I learned
stamina.
About rock and roll time. Right. Yeah.
When you came to New York, Roger, did you seek out immediately a similar scene here?
Oh,
and
for
did
sure.
you find it right away?
Oh, yeah. Well, I knew where to find it because I'd run into Sandy Bull and people like that from New York who had come to visit Chicago. And in fact, it was one of my fondest dreams to come to New York and see the real folk scene, you know, because Chicago's was nice, but it was kind of like the second city. And so I immediately gravitated to Greenwich Village and the places down there, like the Gaslight and the Bitter End and places like that. And in fact, got a job playing it at one coffee house at one point.
Was that your first? For New York, I guess it might have been.
I was working with Darren at the time, but this is a little later. But when I first came there, I didn't get a job. I just sit in at like the Gaslight. I'd get up on stage and play a couple of songs.
Is this pre-Bob Dylan at this point?
No, it was Bob Dylan was around. In fact, I remember running into him at used to be Gertie's Folk City over on 4th Street, and he would get up on the Hootenanny nights and play some songs that were mostly Woody Guthrie songs.
Did you see his potential instantly? What do you remember your first impressions?
Yeah, I do. I remember seeing him as a competitive contemporary, and all the little girls really liked him at Gertie's, you know, and I thought, you know, this guy's got something. But I really didn't, if you'd asked me then if Bob Dylan would ever emerge and be what he finally did come to be, I wouldn't have said so. I wouldn't have thought so. Not that he didn't have talent, but I just didn't see the writing capability.
Yeah,
at that point, because he was doing Woody Guthrie songs and other
right.
folk-type songs.
That's not the first time I'm hearing that. Judy Collins made the same point, and I guess that was a prevalent attitude at the time. Now, in a way, though, your success is so linked to his, and vice versa, because, I mean, although he certainly was successful apart from the Byrds' interpretations of his music, that certainly raised it to a whole new level. How did that cross-pollination come about, so to speak?
Well, Victor Maimutis was Dylan's road manager at the time that he wrote Mr. Tambourine Man. He wrote it at Al Aronowitz's house in New York, and Jack Elliott was on the dub. He just had an acetate of it. And Victor sent it to Jim Dixon, who was our first manager. And Dixon was a friend of Dylan's and Victor's. And Dixon heard the song and somehow was able to see it as a top 40 hit, which I couldn't at all when I heard it. I thought, well, it's a nice, you know, song. It's a good folk song, but it's not I Want to Hold Your Hand or, you know, She Loves You or whatever. And somehow we all auditioned for who was going to sing the lead on it, and I won the audition among the five of us in the group. And we weeded out one verse that we wanted to do that sort of captured the English, you know, feeling, I think. And we did it, and I was really surprised, actually. We cut it in around January, and it was in the can for maybe 6 months, and during that point I almost started another group with Dino Valenti. We were going to have spacesuits and all that stuff, you know, and wireless microphones, and that was attractive to me, being into the gadgets and all that stuff. But then Mr. Tambourine Man was released, and it shot up to number one, and so there went the Byrds. But I was really ready to give up, because I didn't have that much faith in it.
but with as unique a sound as has ever been heard in rock and roll. Those opening notes still do it for me every time. Was that your input, the 12-string, Roger?
Right. I'd been playing 12-string from my folk days. In fact, that's what I played with Bobby Darin, and I'd been into 12-string. It was my favorite instrument because it has that, I don't know, that Baroque kind of sound. I really like that. So when I saw Hard Day's Night, I saw George Harrison playing this Rickenbacker, and I said, wait a minute, that's a 12-string. And see, it was a sneaky 12-string because they worked out the tuning pegs so that three of them were facing sideways and three of them were facing back, and you couldn't see three of them. You know, there were 12 of them. Mm-hmm. That is, six of them were going sideways and six were going back, so it looked like a six-string. And most people thought it was. They didn't think anything of it, but I could tell by the sound that it was a 12-string, so I went out and got one. And that's really, you know, a lot of people think I played it first. I got the idea from Harrison, and also the other, a lot of the other English groups were playing 12-strings mm-hmm. at the time.
Searchers. Kind
of, right.
Yeah. Talking about things going full circle, Hard Day's Night is, of course, playing down the street at your local theater.
In the paper, yeah.
So a whole new generation can go and see the 12-string.
Right.
And start whatever it is they're going to be starting. Listen, I described this up top as the third annual Roger McGuinn Update. We've been doing this now since 81. And every time you come here for one of these, I ask you if you've got something new to do for us. I'm hopeful that that is the case today.
That's right. The recent weather has been pretty severe across the country and around the world. And in California, we were no exception. We got some pretty bad storms, knocked down a bunch of piers, and, you know, did a lot of property damage. Not too many people got hurt, but this is a song that was written during one of those storms called 518.
Okay.
Monday night, the rain's pouring down and we're losing light. The wind's kicking up the crashing waves, but here's where we're gonna stay. The California coast is slipping away. There's less of it now than yesterday. Some say it's not worth the price you pay, but here's where we're gonna stay. The sun beats down and it's nice and warm. We'll make our repairs between the storms. Pop some corn and build a fire and say a little prayer while the tide gets higher. Storms in the winter and fires in the fall. Some years we get no rain at all. A lot of people run from the big earthquake, but here's where we're gonna stay. Silver and lace and a crystal vase. The sea took those and our April rose. 5:18 on a Monday night. The rain's pouring down and we're losing light. The wind's kicking up the crashing waves, but here's where we're gonna stay. The California coast is slipping away. There's less of it now than yesterday. Some say it's not worth the price you pay, but here's where we're gonna stay.
You know, there seems to be a whole body of music coming out of the natural disasters that are going on out there, you know. I had Al Jardine of the Beach Boys up here a couple of weeks ago, and his ranch was also flooded out to some extent. And he's uh-huh. working on a few numbers about it.
No kidding.
You've added to it here. I suppose it's a new ecology category that we'll uh-huh. have to consider for the 80s.
That's interesting. Well, I think it's nice to make something good out of a disaster.
Yeah. Now, you were here last in March of 82, Roger. What's been going on in your life and career since then? Let's make this a legitimate update.
Well, let's see. Since then, I think I've done another tour.
Solo
tour.
Is that gratifying?
Yes, it is. It's great. Camilla and I just travel around together and... The last one we did, we drove. We took our camper, and we actually made it. The one before, we tried to take the camper, and it blew up in Oklahoma. But this time we made it, and it was around 10,000 miles of driving, and it was kind of good.
Is that the first time you were able to do that?
First time I've ever done that, from California to New York and back.
What kind of perceptions did you get from the...
Just great, you know. People really have been enjoying the acoustic show.
Uh-huh.
It's been going over very well.
Folk music, acoustic music, has certainly gotten the short end of the stick from the record business in recent years. I was wondering about someone like yourself and your attitude about that, where you feel its place is in the 80s. Any thoughts on that, Roger?
I'd like to see it come back. As far as the recording thing, I understand where they're coming from. You know, they're in business to make money, and it's a commercial situation, and they're kind of playing copycat. You know, if something happens, they'll follow it. I mean, if somebody got a folk hit, there'd be 20 or 30 record companies hiring folk artists in the next week. So, I mean, that's about what it amounts to.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, and these things do go in cycles, as you well know.
Right.
It leads me to another question that I had for you, Roger, about success. Success came to you relatively early in a very big way, and you have had the proverbial hills and valleys since then. How do you relate to that? How do you define it?
Well, I define success now as just enjoying what I'm doing and having a good life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't be happier, really. I mean, more success would place more pressure on me, and it might be more financially rewarding, but I'm not sure it would be more fun. I won't turn it down, but, you know.
If you had it all to do over again, knowing what you know now, would there have been any changes, any different ways of doing things during the Byrds heyday, for example?
Well, in retrospect, I certainly would have... I wouldn't have done all the drugs I did. I don't think that helped anything.
Ah.
I don't think it helped my music or my state of mind or my health or anything. So,
one of the things that concerns me a great deal is that there are very few role models for rock and rollers at other stages of the life cycle besides...
Well, most of them don't survive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I guess we're counting on guys like you to start filling the vacuum.
Well... Hopefully.
The title of this next song that I asked you about intrigues me. It's called Sweet Memories.
Right.
What can you tell me about that?
Well, Camilla and I wrote that about going on the road. And going on the road is great. I mean, for me, a lot of people don't like it, but I've always enjoyed it. And it's like a paid vacation or something. And this song is about just traveling around and enjoying it, having a good time at it.
Would you do it for us?
California summers, New England falls, Colorado winters, the wild wind calls, the wild wind calls. Springtime dogwoods blossom in every southern town, and now's the time to get around. Sweet memories we will have, sweet memories, yes, we'll have, sweet memories. You and me. From the Rock at Morro Bay to Cape Cod Sounds, Davis Island Lighthouse, Circus Clowns, Sarasota Clowns, and Mrs. Wilkes for dinner in old Savannah Town. Now's the time to get around. memories. We will have sweet memories. Yes, we'll have sweet memories. You and me.
Like that a lot.
Thank you.
That's a brand new one called Sweet Memories. One of the memories that I wanted to talk about today, Roger, was inspired by a listener of ours who's been writing me and phoning me since your last appearance here to ask about a gentleman that you were associated for a while who met a tragic end, unfortunately, and that is Clarence White.
Yeah.
Who played in one of the incarnations of the Byrds. This fellow is a big fan of his and, in fact, listed a whole bunch of things down here that I didn't know, and I guess you didn't know some of it either, that Clarence had played the lead guitar on Arlo Guthrie's Coming into Los Angeles, and that he had played with the Everly Brothers and the Monkees and Rick Nelson and Linda Ronstadt and, of course, the Byrds. What kind of memories do you have of the late Clarence White?
Well, he was my best friend at that point, and he was an excellent guitar player. I remember one time working at a club in Los Angeles, and Jimi Hendrix came backstage, you know, and and went running right over to Clarence and hugged him, you know.
That's
all he wanted to see was Clarence. I mean, he really loved him, I think you were saying Jimmy Page's...
There's another quote here that says Jimmy Page, formerly of Led Zeppelin, is quoted as saying that Clarence White was his favorite guitarist next to Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
So there was a meeting of giants in the dressing room that night. One thing that through every incarnation of the Byrds, the sound managed to stay the same. That seems to me... very hard when you consider the different types of talents that were involved at different times.
Uh-huh. Well, I wasn't aware of that, that it stayed the same.
In the sense of you always knew it to be the Byrds.
Uh-huh.
You know, there were different directions musically, but that sound stayed the same from the first right till the end. And, of course, wait a minute. I know what I'm getting at here. You were the common element in all of that. How
well,
silly.
I did stay in the group the longest, yeah.
And that time of transition from the end of the Byrds to going solo, did you have any difficulty with that?
Well, I sort of have mixed feelings about whether I should have broken it up or not. The reason I did it was because David Crosby persuaded me to, you know.
Hmm.
It was, we were going to get back together and do an original Byrds album, a reunion album, and I sort of felt guilty about having the name The Byrds out there and not, you know, including the original guys, and so I disbanded The Byrds that were with Clarence and those guys at that point, and it was really a good thing. I mean, we had a good thing going. It was kind of unfortunate in a way to hang it up, but I did for the sake of the reunion album, which didn't turn out too well. A lot of people said they like it, but
and there are songs on it that
there are some good things on it. Yeah.
Really hold
like,
up,
like For Free and I like that.
And you did one later on again in a new
Born to Rock and Roll.
Yeah,
right.
I like that a lot. Both ways,
okay.
I like it both ways.
But anyway, I did hang it up, and it was a tough period. The immediate. Several albums on my own with Columbia were kind of discouraging. You know, I went out and what was going to be Roger McGuinn, and it's a tough road to go after you've been in a group for a number of years.
But even there, every album contained that gem or two that I would love to see collected somewhere, sometime, in one place. Is there any possibility that that will occur?
Hey, you have to talk to CBS about that. They have all the masters.
I think I'll do that.
Yeah. There was a, you probably got it, a radio anthology.
Of the birds.
Was it the birds? I think it was the Roger McGuinn one.
Really? Yeah. No, I'm not familiar with that.
Right.
I will definitely check into that.
Yeah, there is a Roger McGuinn radio anthology.
And let our listeners know. Could that happen again? Do you think about that? I mean, if those five guys got together at another point in time and tried to make music together, could it happen?
Uh-uh. I don't think so.
Because?
I don't know. I really don't want to try it at this point.
Yeah.
I feel that I just want to be Roger McGuinn and just go on from here. And it's still a tough road to go, but I just want to stick it out. It's sort of like Pete Seeger when he left the Weavers. You know, everybody said, why didn't you get back together with the Weavers? And he's been Pete Seeger for 20 years now.
Yeah, now there's a role model for an awful lot of people.
Right.
He's going to be coming up here in a few weeks, by the way.
I know. I'm thrilled. I'd love to hear that.
We will certainly see to it that you do. Your stage show currently, Roger, I understand that it is different than the last time around. Anything you could tell us about that?
Yeah, I've started incorporating the story of Trip, which is the musical that Jacques Levy and I wrote that had such things as Chestnut Mirror and Lover of the Bayou in it. I'm doing basically four songs from it, but I'm telling a little bit of the outline of the story to go along with it, so it's a little, kind of, it strings them all together.
Uh-huh. You've been very busy in our area in recent weeks. There was a show at the Palladium and one at the Capitol over in New Jersey, and of course Folk City. Was that a homecoming in a sense?
Well, I played there last about 6 months ago, and it's great, it's under new management since the old days when I used to hang out there, but it's the same feeling.
Well, I think we have accomplished what we set out to do annually here, which is the Roger McGuinn update. I'm going to count on you for a commitment for next year already.
For sure.
And I'm going to ask you, if you would not mind, closing with one of the songs from the Birds days. You've done for us in past visits things like Tambourine Man and Turn, Turn, Turn and Chestnut Mare, but I think this one would be appropriate for today. Do you want to do it?
Sure.
Okay.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, growing high and mighty trap. Countless fire and flame and road, using ideas as my map. Well, meet on edges soon, said I, bright neath heated brown. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. In a soldier's stance, I eat my hand at the mongrel dogs who teach, fearing that I'd become my enemy in the instant that I preach. My existence, led by confusion, brought mutiny from stern to bow. Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Yeah, my guard stood hard when abstract threats, too noble to neglect, deceived me into thinking I had something to protect. Good and bad, I define these terms quite clear, no doubt somehow. But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Half-wrecked prejudice leap forth, tear down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white spoke from my skull I dream. Romantic flanks of musketeers, foundation deep somehow. But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. But I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Well, thank you, Roger McGuinn, and we'll see you next year for the fourth annual update.
Okay, Pete.
Always alone, never with a friend. Prettiest mare I've ever seen, you have to take my word. Up on Stony Ridge after this chestnut mare, been chasing her for weeks. Well, I'd catch a glimpse of her every once in a while, taking her meal and bathing. Fine lady. This one day I happened to be real close to her and I saw her standing over there, so I snuck up on her nice and easy, got my rope out, and I flung it in the air. I'm gonna do just that off. I'm gonna do just that off. I'm gonna do just that off if I can. I'm gonna do just that off.
It was described at the time as an instant birds classic. That's Chestnut Mare, and in the years since, it has certainly lived up to that description. My thanks to Roger McGuinn for joining us on the program today. This is Pete Fornital on Mixed Bag at NEWFM. And a couple of weeks ago, when Tom Rush was my guest, we conducted a little experiment, which I promised that I would report to you about. Now, here is a letter I received this week, which I'd like to read to you. Dear Pete, just a note to let you know that the response to the Mixed Bag segment that we did has been excellent. The New Yorker ad has generated a very good response nationwide, so good that we will be rerunning it in the May 9th issue. About half of the people ordering from the NEWFM listening area mention your show, and many, in fact, have indicated that they don't normally read the New Yorker and would have missed the ad were it not for your mentioning it. Thanks again for your support. I'll let you know if Mixed Bag is mentioned in the response to the May 9th ad. Warmest regards, Tom Rush.
So wasn't that a mighty storm? Wasn't that a mighty storm in the morning? Well, wasn't that a mighty storm? It blew all the people all away. Chilling many years ago, death come howling on the ocean. Death calls, you got to go. Wasn't that a mighty storm? You put wasn't your that a mighty storm in the morning? Well, wasn't that a mighty storm? Blew all the people all away.
The dark side, saying, please, son, don't take this trip. I said, mama, sweet mama, don't you worry none. Even God couldn't sink this ship. Well, the whistle blew, and they turned the screws. It turned the water into foam. Destination, sweet salvation. Goodbye, home, sweet home. I'm in the dance band on the Titanic. Sing near my God to thee. The iceberg's on the starboard bow. Won't you dance with me? Dance band on the Titanic. Sing near my God to thee. The iceberg's on the starboard bow.
NEWFM. That is Harry Chapin and the title track from Dance Band on the Titanic. Tom Rush before that, Wasn't That a Mighty Storm, from his album A New Year. Mail order only for that one. You can find out more about it in the May 9th issue of the New Yorker magazine. If you do, please mention Mixed Bag. This is Pete Fornatale. I would like to acknowledge one more birthday today. It takes place tomorrow, and it's an old favorite of mine, Richie Furay. Here's a great lead vocal Richie did in the Buffalo Springfield days.